I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 6th of May. I just love topics like the one we're about to discuss. You probably are aware of this. A couple weeks ago, during a panel event on water in the universe, this panel of distinguished scientists from NASA and elsewhere started talking about life elsewhere, and the top scientist from NASA said she predicted we will find signs of alien life by 2025, with even stronger evidence for extraterrestrials in the years that follow. I thought this would make a terrific talk show. It's definitely not an if, it's a when, said other people on the panel. A NASA astronomer said, I think in the next 20 years, we will find out that we are not alone in the universe. So this hour, we're going to be talking about what scientists are doing to help figure out if we're alone in the universe, and if we're not alone in the universe, how do you find extraterrestrials? That's the subject of the hour. Dr. Margaret Turnbull is our guest. She's an astrobiologist with the Global Science Institute in Madison and the SETI Institute in California. She specializes in identifying star and planetary systems that may be capable of supporting life as we know it. She developed a catalog of habitable stellar systems for use in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and she has studied the spectrum of the Earth to identify telltale signatures of life. She's worked with NASA to develop a new starshade concept for finding Earth-like worlds among the nearest stars. And we'll welcome phone calls for Dr. Turnbull. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. I always hoped this would happen during my lifetime. I guess it won't, but maybe it will. You never know. Dr. Turnbull, thank you very much for being with us. It should be a fascinating hour.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Thanks so much for having me.
So that article that I read in the paper a couple of weeks ago just stood right out, and I said, okay, here's a talk show, because so many members of the panel thought that we, within 20 to 30 years, are going to have definite evidence of life beyond Earth.
Isn't it remarkable?
Yes, it is.
When they talk about, you know, how far we've come in the last 50 years, John Grunfeld was on that panel. He was one of the guys who has serviced the Hubble telescope. More than once, he's been into orbit and changed instruments out on the Hubble Space Telescope. And he had, you know, he just made the comment that, look at how far we've come in 50 years. And when we imagined, you know, when the Hubble was first launched and when we imagined that telescope, you know, we didn't even know of a single planet orbiting a star other than our own. And now Hubble is being used to actually study the atmospheres of some planets orbiting nearby stars. So it's like, where are we going to be then in another 20 years?
Yeah. So we have something like 4,000 exoplanets that are being evaluated now? 4,000?
Yeah. And, I mean, not all of those are confirmed, but most of them will be. And most of them are real. And that is largely thanks to the NASA Kepler mission at this point, which has been staring at a very dense, densely covered patch of sky with lots of stars in it, and just monitoring their brightness to see if any of them have planets passing in front of the star from our perspective. So, you know, that's a fairly, relatively easy detection to make if the alignment happens to be right on. And so Kepler is responsible for the bulk of that planet harvest so far.
The top scientist for NASA was quoted as saying, I think we're going to have, well, I already said that, strong indications of life beyond Earth within a decade. She said, we know where to look, we know how to look, and in most cases we have the technology and we're on a path to implementing it. Let's start with the first part of that statement. How do we know where to look?
We know where to look because we understand some of the basics of water, and liquid water seems to be, you know, the baseline for life as we know it. And we have explored our own solar system enough now to kind of realize where liquid water can be found. And we know that, you know, for example, Earth is covered with oceans, and that really is, that's crucial for life on this planet. And there's really only a narrow zone around a star where the temperature is right for liquid water to be running around on the surface of a planet. You know, if you get too close to the star, it all boils away, it's too hot. Get too far away, it freezes over, it's too cold. But what the solar system has taught us is that there are other ways to get liquid water further out in the solar system, like these icy moons in orbit around Saturn and Jupiter, they have gravitational interactions with those big planets that are heating up their interiors and giving rise to these huge subsurface oceans. So, for example, Jupiter's moon Europa could have and does almost certainly have an ocean, saltwater ocean, underneath the ice that contains much more water than all of our oceans.
Mm. And if there's water, there is what?
If there's water, then there's a medium for chemistry to occur, the kind of complex carbon-based chemistry that we see being the foundation, the basic building blocks for life as we know it. You have to have some way of chemical energy of being moved around and transferred in any kind of living system. So that's the medium that we're looking at because we know it works.
And tell me more about the technology that we have developed over the past 50 years, how we're using that technology, and what technology we have yet perhaps to develop that would be really important in this search.
Right. Well, one of the key technologies, it's almost easier for me to talk about technology that we need to develop, but, as an astronomer, I live in the world of remote sensing. I'm used to seeing things from far away, so I inherently just think about what kinds of technology do we need in order to get better images of nearby star systems and actually see those planets orbiting around the stars. We can't do that right now. That's very, except for in just a very tiny handful of cases where you have big planets or even larger than planets like brown dwarfs orbiting the nearest stars. Very hard to separate out the light of that planet from the light of the star because the star is just so glaring. So one of the upcoming technologies and that we want to develop better is just to simply suppress the starlight so that you can see the planets around them.
Mm-hmm.
And we can do that with what we call a coronagraph, where you just physically block out the light of the star inside the telescope. And we already have examples of coronagraphs that have been used. They have to get a lot better to see planets around nearby stars. Or you can use what we call a star shade, where you just fly a big, huge, kind of star-shaped, flower-shaped piece of plastic in space in front of your telescope and block out the light of the star so that you can see the light of all the little planets coming around the edges of that. But that's, these are technologies that, yes, they are advanced, but they're not beyond our capability, our current capability. So NASA's pursuing both of those options, pretty enthusiastically.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
I was reading the SETI site this morning, and it talked about after 9 years, this stuff just flabbergasts me. After 9 years en route, the New Horizons spacecraft is nearing Pluto for the July 14 flyby. Will that teach us anything? And are there other spacecraft out there right now that will allow us to see more of those stars?
Well, I think that New Horizons is really exciting because I can't believe that's 9 years. I remember when it was launched. It doesn't seem like it was that long ago, but it was. But, yeah, we don't know what we're going to see when it gets there. And understanding more about what these bodies are like in the outer solar system, these icy bodies, I think will help us learn more, yes, about how the volatile material, like water, is distributed in planetary systems and in our own planetary system in particular. But I just think that any time you go to a new world like that, you just you don't know what kinds of doors are going to be opened as far as putting all the puzzle pieces together as far as how our own solar system formed and why our own planet is habitable.
Mm-hmm. The other thing they made mention of is the Allen Telescope array is being upgraded with more sensitive radio receivers capable of working at even higher frequencies to improve the search for other technological civilizations.
Right. Yeah, and the Allen Telescope array, I mean, that was, for me, that was the incentive originally for putting together a list or trying to put together a list of potentially habitable nearby star systems that the Allen Telescope Array could focus on. And it's a cool concept for an observatory because it's a radio observatory. It's ground-based. It's in Northern California. And it consists of many small radio dishes with a lot of off-shelf components, so relatively inexpensive. A lot of customization went into that. A lot of thought went into that. But what they can do is just divide up the array and look at more than one target at a time, or they can use the array in special ways so that they avoid looking at overpassing satellites and stuff, because SETI's biggest problem is just trying to see past all the radio noise that humans make on Earth in order to look for signals coming from other star systems. So it's a really cool, like, very flexible and, you know, relatively speaking, inexpensive kind of investigation to do. And how cool would that be if they actually got a signal and with information about, you know, just tell us what your planet is like.
I know. I want that to happen so much. I've waited for that for years and years and years. And I'm sure that you would be as excited as anybody. When you said you were putting together a list of potentially habitable stars, how long is your list?
Well, the list that I put together, this was in grad school. I worked on this as part of my PhD dissertation and, you know, against the advice of many advisors. But I thought it was very interesting and pulled together all the pieces I could at the time and came up with a list of about 19,000 star systems. That
oh, my passed. Goodness.
Yeah, I mean, I had a handful of criteria that each star system had to pass in order to be accepted onto the list of being potentially habitable, and basically I just was ruling out stars that were clearly not good. You know, either there was more than one star in the system, and that would make the existence of planets very difficult, or there were no metals in the star's atmosphere, which means that probably planets would have very low metal content, and maybe you wouldn't find rocky planets in those systems, and a number of other criteria that I came up with that seemed reasonable at the time. And now, even since then, we've got so much more data to work with that I've toyed with the idea of completely revising that list, or starting with a much more enhanced list of stars to work with and doing it again.
Well, you don't have to tell us, but I hope you got an A on the paper.
Got a PhD, so.
There you go. That's good. We're going to welcome phone calls for our audience. Dr. Margaret Turnbull is our guest this hour. She's an astrobiologist. She's with the Global Science Institute in Madison, also with SETI Institute in California, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And this caught our attention, this little news blurb just a couple of weeks ago. It was a panel of top scientists, and the top scientist at NASA said that she predicted we will find signs of alien life by 2025, and almost everybody in the panel agreed, and there are all kinds of studies that are going on now. We'll hear about more of them from Dr. Turnbull. It's not an if, it's a when, said others on the panel, and a NASA astronomer, Kevin Hahn, said, I think in the next 20 years we'll find out we are not alone in the universe. So what are all these scientists doing in terms of looking at what's way out there in terms of looking at other stars? How do we see those other stars? How do we gather information? Why does the list keep growing to a huge thousands of potential stars now when it started out with just one exoplanet not very long ago? We're talking about all of those issues. Does life exist elsewhere? Are there other technological life? This is a good one. Are there other technological life forms? And if we fantasize about what they may be, what may they be? All right, we'll welcome your phone calls. And here's how you reach us. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to our conversation about life on other planets. Dr. Margaret Turnbull is our guest, and we're welcoming phone calls at 800-486-8655, starting with Colleen in Sharon. Hi, Colleen.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, Colleen.
Hi, yes. Well, Kathleen, thank you for the show. Wonderful, as always. And I do have a question for Dr. Turnbull. Basically, what do you think of the new movie Interstellar and the science around habitable planets? It's my new favorite movie. The old one used to be 2001, and I just wanted your scientific opinion.
Wow. Well, I thought I did see it, and I thought it was incredibly imaginative. I actually had the privilege of meeting the guy who is the director, producer, writer of Interstellar.
Oh.
And I wish that I could have talked with him a little bit more about it and asked some questions. I know that he had a science advisor who is extremely well known for his work in black holes and space-time theory. And it was so imaginative, and I would like to see it again, actually, just to try to wrap my mind around it. But I loved the concept of, you know, these realms, exploring these, the idea of there being realms in the galaxy that you wouldn't normally think of as having much to offer as far as life goes. But, you know, like surrounding a black hole, like that's not a top target in the search for life right now, but what a cool concept. And just the idea of time passing so differently on those worlds is definitely something that, you know, I'd love to, you know, be able to sit down with Kip Thorne or somebody, you know, who really understands space-time, you know, theory around, you know, in those extreme environments around black holes and, you know, give more clarity on, is this really, you know, is that really what that would be like? But it kind of opens up other ideas about habitable worlds in the galaxy existing in places where it could actually be very difficult to communicate with them, or their whole sense of the passage of time would be very different from ours.
Hmm. So when you, in your the wildest of your imagination, when you think about how we could communicate, what comes to mind?
Oh my goodness. Well, speed of light is just excruciatingly slow. And when it comes to size, you know, length scales that are across the galaxy like that. So if you want a two-way conversation to occur between, you know, civilizations that exist in different star systems, There has to be some other physics that comes into play, or there has to be a way around that, you know, perhaps involving warping of space-time or wormholes or tunnels through space-time that can shorten that length somehow and allow signals to get through more quickly than just, you know, the standard distance, you know, for light to have to travel between these star systems. You know, even though light is the fastest speed that, you know, physics will allow in the universe, it still is just too darn slow to have a very satisfying conversation. We've got to come up with something here.
Thanks, Colleen, so much for your call. Chris in Green Bay, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I have a question on the concept of von Neumann machines. We have the idea that they would be made out of robots or, you know, machinery. I heard the idea one time that they could be made out of biology, microorganisms
right. That
float from planet to planet or star system to star system. Is there any more continuation on that theory or possibility?
And can you explain a little more what those are, please?
Yeah, this is the concept of, you know, it kind of comes down to this Fermi paradox, where this question of
if we're not alone, you know, if life is common in the universe, then where is it? Because even if there was one technological civilization that could have arisen in the history of the universe, and that civilization could have invented a probe that was capable of self-replicating. These von Neumann machines or von Neumann machines are self-replicating things. So send a probe to another planet, it harvests the resources that it needs and builds a couple more probes, which then launch themselves off. Mm-hmm. And really in a short amount of time, relatively short amount of time, if you do it that way, you should have sent a probe to every single planet or star system in the whole galaxy. So how come we haven't seen anything like that is one of the questions. And, you know, but the caller's question was about biology. And I think that, you know, if you look at biology as self-replicating and potentially interstellar traveling entities, then, you know, that might fall, yes, under that category. I mean, maybe the von Neumann probes are us, and it's just a matter of figuring how to get ourselves off of our planet and onto, you know, actually out there and exploring planetary systems in the neighborhood. And we're self-replicating. We could do that and eventually, you know, travel throughout the whole entire galaxy. Just, you know, it's taking us however long it's going to take us in order to become truly spacefaring.
Hmm. Thanks, Chris. Sally in Middleton, hi.
Hello. On our Channel 21, there was a wonderful program that finally woke me up to, that guy that used to say billions and billions and billions of stars. Well, they were just focusing on our galaxy, and to my surprise, I realized there are many, many, many galaxies. We are just in one, and that it just goes on forever. Not Einstein has or had an idea of an ending to any of it.
Right. Well, I would encourage, this is wonderful, this is a wonderful point. So I would encourage everybody listening to this program right now, if you haven't already seen it, it'll take 5 minutes, go online and just Google Hubble Ultra Deep Field.
Hubble Ultra Deep?
Deep Field. And the Deep Field project, that was like the keystone project for the Hubble Space Telescope.
Mm-hmm.
What they did was they used Hubble to point at a tiny little patch of sky that had no stars in it and stare at that little patch of sky for 10 days or more and just see what emerged after collecting all of that, the light coming from that little patch of sky. And what emerges is thousands of galaxies outside our own. And it doesn't matter what direction you point in, there are thousands of galaxies in a tiny little patch of sky. So if you think about our own galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, say 400 billion stars approximately, there are as many galaxies then in the rest of the universe, as there are stars in our own galaxy. So 400 billion stars times 400 billion galaxies, you know, stretched throughout the visible universe. And, of course, that's just the visible universe. There's no confirmation at all that the universe has any kind of end to it. It may well be infinite in extent. And that does bring up a lot of questions as far as how you can even imagine that we would be the only life forms here.
Right. What happens to you? I've talked to other people when I was a kid, and even now I'm no longer a kid, but you sit out in your front yard or you're on a little lake looking up at all the stars, and you can sort of just do this time travel, or you get reduced to these basic questions of what's this all about, Alfie? Why are we here? How did we get formed? What is out there? What's it all about? And you can't come up with very many answers. But I'm wondering, when you do that, because you know a lot about what you're seeing out there, what happens to you? Do you get into this existential kind of space wondering what it's all about, or do you have a much better sense than we do of what it's all about?
I don't have a better sense than anybody else. And I do get into that existential space of what it's all about. And, you know, as something that is part of my daily life, where I'm working with the stars, trying to figure them out, lately I've been undertaking the excruciating task of just simply trying to make a clean list of all the stars that are in the solar neighborhood. I'm not the only one who has attempted this, and it's just absolutely a bear, because every single star system has little quirks and oddities about it. But trying to understand the stars as individuals and then trying to understand them collectively as well and how we fit into that picture is just a multi-generational process. And how does that affect how we see ourselves, how we behave, the kinds of things that we're interested in and
right.
about every day? I mean, I've been woken up with visions in the middle of the night just imagining our whole universe as like this network of life, you know, and living creatures, and some of them are in contact with each other and some of them are still emerging as far as being able to communicate or travel between the stars. And I just think that's it's a really interesting vision. I don't know if it's accurate or not, but it's something that I'm really interested in pushing forward. That's a horizon that, on behalf of humanity, I
yes.
personally am interested in advancing.
Oh, fascinating. Tim writes on Facebook, I know the search for life centers around water-based life forms, but in theory, other forms of biology may be possible. Can you comment on this?
Yeah, there are scientists, NASA scientists, and other scientists that are exploring that question of alternative biochemistries. It's theoretical at this point. You know, you can't ever rule something out just because you haven't found it yet. But one of the reasons that the push, I'm sure probably the person asking already knows this, but one of the reasons we push so hard on this question of water and the other familiar building blocks of life, carbon-based, is simply because we know that it works, at least here, and can be very diverse. And we also know that those building blocks of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, those building blocks plus water are very common throughout the universe, and we know where to look for signs of liquid water and habitability to life as we know it. So those ingredients all added up together make it just inevitable that that's how we're going to start with our search. But having said that, we are exploring other kinds of environments. I mean, there, you know, the Huygens probe that was dropped into Titan's atmosphere and landed there, that is a completely different kind of environment with its own cycle based on, you know, methane-ethane lakes and ocean and weather cycle. And who's to say that there couldn't be some form of metabolism, self-replicating thing that's taking advantage of that? And we can theorize about it here, but ultimately we just have to go and look. And if we find it, then we'll know.
Hmm. Sally, thanks for your call. Walter in Lake Mills. Hi.
Hi. Well, you know, I've been reading books on this subject matters for decades now. I actually worked on telescopes way back when. And I started reading books. And first I read about these things called the Palladians, the Pleiades and all that. And then I came across this guy named David Icke. And he came out, he was going on about this whole theory about the Egyptians mating with aliens and creating this whole race of hybrid people, and I thought it was crazy at first. But then, you know, you start to look at people like Michelle Bachmann and them, and they're with the crazy.
Yeah, you're off on another track here. Let's go to Ray in Rhinelander. Hi, Ray.
Hi.
Hi.
I really like what's being presented here. This person that you have on is just has an amazing mind that definitely goes into the art of abstract thinking and exploration. So, I think using the math of, see, math is universal in the universe, on the planet, physics, and everything. Math is a consistent factor on looking at reality. So looking at what she's saying, looking at the amount of research that's being done to look out there further, how would it not be probable that there is inhabited other planets? There are different forms of life and how they could travel, anywhere from physically traveling or even mind connection. I know that sounds a little trippy, but you know, look at the math of everything, and then you know, use your mind to explore it. And have you ever heard of a book called the Urantia Book? It's a very interesting book that I would suggest she look at this and just observe it. And I'll take this off the
All
air.
All right, Ray. Yeah, thanks for the call.
Yeah, thanks. You know, I'm always interested in different people's takes on how we might communicate or how civilizations evolve. I mean, Isaac Asimov was one of my absolute favorites, you know, as far as imagining, you know, different capabilities that we might tap into over time. And it's not that currently the scientific investigations that we're doing, they're based on what we know and what we can demonstrate repeatedly, and that will certainly change, you know, over time. That's how science works. But, you know, today there's always going to be, you know, speculations that are purely imaginative, and I don't avoid that at all. I think it's very interesting and stimulating, and I'm able to keep my feet really rooted in solid, you know, scientific procedures while I work. But I still enjoy, you know, just more imaginative takes on where we might go and how we might communicate in the future.
Are there studies of, I know we're looking at our planet, are there studies of maybe the ocean on our planet or other planets? I was reading this morning about Venus, which may be worth very careful study to help figure out the geological evolution of Earth. Are there other planets that are worthy of more serious scientific study because of the answers they'll give us about other solar systems, about other life, or about our own planet?
Sure. Well, NASA is definitely also moving forward on the human exploration front, the human space flight program. And one of the major goals is to get a sample return mission from Mars. So sending people to Mars, making sure they survive the trip, figuring out how to land on the ground, doing a geological expedition, bringing back samples, getting back into, you know, out off the surface, and then returning safely home with those samples would be just a major achievement, and that's something we would obviously have to practice many times in order to become, you know, spacefaring beyond our own solar system. But there's huge value in that kind of expedition, because we can do a lot with remote sensing and with telescopes, and that's the world that I live in. But meanwhile, you know, the instruments that we have here on the ground are always better when it comes to learning, you know, what planets are made of. And so if we can actually bring something back, maybe look for signs of, you know, processing by liquid water in the past, or even fossils or dormant, you know, microbes or anything that's been preserved in the rock, or even below the surface, if we can drill into Mars, maybe some sort of extant water table or seepage that is currently supporting, you know, some organisms down there. I mean, that would shed a lot of light, I think, on the history of life in our solar system and just the limits of what is possible. And you know, if, you know, there are scientists who think that it's very plausible that life on Earth may have been seeded originally by life that got going on Mars, because Mars may have been, you know, more habitable in the past and definitely had liquid water running around on the surface. And there were impacts with comets that would have blown pieces off of Mars that eventually landed on Earth. And we've even found meteorites on Earth that we know did come from Mars. They've got little pockets of Martian atmosphere in them. And that's a clear route for exchanging material and potentially life forms between the planets.
Mm. And what about here on Earth, Dr. Turnbull? Are there parts of the ocean? Is there some part of Earth we haven't really discovered that would give us more answers?
Possibly. So there is the NASA Astrobiology Program has a lot of geologists and oceanographers working working on those kinds of questions with, you know, doing deep sea exploration, drilling of ancient seabeds to just see what the Earth, you know, what kinds of changes the Earth has been through in deep time, and explorations where geologists are going to the driest places on the planet, like the Atacama Desert in Chile or the dry valleys of Antarctica, in order to kind of find these Martian analog environments where, you know, it's just very dry and very cold, and ask the question, well, what kinds of organisms are living there now? And exploring in the northern polar regions as well for, you know, underneath permanently frozen over lakes, you know, as analogs for something like Europa, and just kind of investigating, you know, what are the limits of life even on our own planet?
Right. More phone calls in just one moment. This hour, this news item caught our attention a couple weeks ago. We love these kinds of discussions anyhow, but there was a panel of NASA scientists and others a couple weeks ago, and NASA's top scientist said, I think we're going to have strong indications of life beyond Earth within a decade, and I think we're going to have definitive evidence within 20 to 30 years. There will be extraterrestrials found in the years that follow, and almost everybody on the panel said, this is not just an if, this is a when this is going to happen. And so we thought it was worthy of exploration. Dr. Margaret Turnbull is our guest. She's an astrobiologist. She is with the Global Science Institute in Madison and the SETI Institute in California, specializes in identifying star and planetary systems that may be capable of supporting life as we know it. 800-486-8655 is our number. Our email is talk@wpr.org. You can always leave messages on our Facebook page and use your imaginations when you write things there. Why not? Imaginations are good in this regard. And we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Margaret Turnbull, our guest this hour. Let's go to Chet next in Janesville. Hi, Chet.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It was towards the end of February, I believe, that I sat next to Dr. Turnbull, and we were on a flight down to Phoenix, and I was going down to backpack and superstitions for 5 nights. And we talked. I'd heard her on another program as well. And talked a little bit, but I do have a question, and that is, what's the likelihood of finding invertebrates in, like, Europa or some of the other moons that are circling Jupiter?
Such a great question, and I hope your hike in the superstitions went well. I've thought of them since then.
It did. But, very well.
Great. Well, yeah, that's... I mean, that kind of is the question that we're trying to get our minds around right now. Like, how often in a given kind of environment does a certain kind of life evolve, successfully evolve and get going and sustain itself? And, you know, Europa is a wonderful example of an alternative kind of test case where you have plenty of liquid water, you presumably have plenty of interfaces with between liquid water and mineral surfaces as well. Maybe there's hydrothermal vents down there underneath the ice that are spewing chemicals, you know, useful chemicals into that water, keeping it warm in certain spots. But the question is, with Europa, you know, can you get complex life, or, you know, do you need more sunlight in order for something like photosynthesis to evolve? And then with oxygen being produced, then you can get more complex life, you know, the way that it happened here on Earth was, you know, until photosynthesis was invented, everything was microbial. And it was only after oxygen became readily available and poisoned the atmosphere that multicellular, you know, complex organisms and animals, you know, started running around on the surface. So it's a different it's such a different kind of environment, and to go there and explore and ask that question, you know, is it gonna, is there any life here at all, and is there anything multicellular down here at all? You know, that in itself would be, you know, a huge piece of the puzzle, you know, as far as understanding what's possible with different kinds of resources available.
Indeed. Thank you.
Thank you, Chet, very much.
Thanks.
Thanks for your call. You mentioned that Hubble site to look at. Are there other places we ought to go and look at some wonderful things in the heavens?
Well, I think that so the solar system is just full of riches, even just our one little planetary system. And we could have so many different missions to the planets and the moons, the water-bearing moons especially, that, you know, would be so interesting to explore. I would love to. NASA does have a mission planned for Europa. It's the Europa Clipper mission.
Mm.
It's currently planned to be an orbiter. But I wish that mission would evolve to include some kind of probe or lander, because we just need to get underneath that ice and see what's down there. And I don't think we should hold back. I think we should do it now. but and we're capable of it, and we should just do it. But as far as, you know, outside our own solar system, it's just, I mean, it's boundless. And starting with the nearest sun-like stars, you know, to launch one mission that is capable of blocking out that starlight so that we can just look directly and see, are there planets orbiting around these guys, and keep advancing, you know, according to what we find, you know, then keep developing new generations of instruments that are capable of really looking at those planets in detail and asking, you know, is there signs of water in those atmospheres? Are there signs of interesting surface signatures like continents or even forests, plants? I mean, plants have been broadcasting their presence into the galaxy for, you know, hundreds of millions of years. Photosynthesis and chlorophyll in their leaves is a very recognizable signature on the surface of our planet. That's something that could be detected,
yes,
with that kind of technology. But I'll say this, too, and this is something that will make other astronomers chuckle. I think that we should get busy and put together a probe mission to another star system. I think that we should launch a probe to Alpha Centauri and go there and do some recon. And, yeah, it would take a long time to get there. But and, yes, the thing would have to have its own artificial intelligence in order to make its own decisions once it got there, because you've got, you know, I mean, it's 4 light-years away, so that's too long of a lag time to
right.
talk to it. But the next generation then, you know, if we did that now, the next generation would have some, you know, would start getting some, you know, replies from that mission and images and close-up, you know, pictures of those stars that are in Alpha Centauri A and B. They're a binary system. And some recon with regard to planets in those systems, some close-up pictures maybe. But I think we should just stop worrying about how difficult it is and just do it.
I'm with you. We're not very good, though, at thinking about the next generation sometimes.
Right. I mean, it would definitely, that one is a longer-term project. But, you know, as of July, the United States is going to be the only nation to have visited every single planet in our solar system. And I think that we should continue pushing that envelope out further and visit the nearest star system.
I'm with you. All right. We'll start a petition. That's good. Let's go to Byron in Portage. Hi, Byron.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi, Byron.
I want to talk to the professor about I seen a UFO in 1970. Up by River Falls. I'm from that area. And then my folks seen something in 1979, another UFO, and that was south of the Ellsworth area, about 2 miles.
How many UFO reports are there in Wisconsin or in this country? And are there any, do you give any of those reports validity? Do they need further investigation, Dr. Turnbull?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm so mad at myself that I don't know the answer to how many UFO reports there are. I mean, I know that, you know, pilots report things that they see and don't know what it was.
Sure.
And, you know, people, of course, you know, anybody who spends a reasonable amount of time looking at the stars at night is going to see things, you know, sooner or later, see something sooner or later that they don't know what that was. And, you know, there are a lot of things that just happen naturally. I mean, from meteorites to storms, lightning, you know, things that people do with weather balloons and, you know, little different floaty light things that people send up on holidays and stuff like that, that all are, you know, kind of mysterious if you don't know what they are. And, but, you know, that doesn't mean that they shouldn't, you know, we should investigate all the things that we don't know what they are. It's just a matter of being able to follow up. So when somebody says, I saw a UFO, I, as a scientist, you know, I naturally, well, I'd like to know what that was too. I just have no way of really commenting on it because I have no information to follow up on it. So that's the biggest problem. And what I wish is that somebody would invent an app for the phone, for the iPhone, that would allow you, it would be, you know, the UFOmeter and the UFO meter. And you could, when you see a UFO, if you're fast enough on the draw, you could get your phone up, point it at the UFO as it's flying by, and it would take a photo. And more importantly than a photo, because I'll tell you what, 99% of astronomy is not photographs. It's not images. It's actually spectra. Like, we need to take that light and break it down into all of its colors. And if we have a spectrum of it, then I can start to tell you things like, how fast was it moving? What direction was it going? What was it made of? And was it rotating? And when I have that kind of information to work with, then I can start to answer these questions. And, you know, if we had, if we could crowdsource UFO data collected this way, then, you know, we could start to get a handle on this. But as of, you know, as of right now, with the paucity of information, I would have to probably just reply, well, it was probably, you know, an aircraft or a weather balloon or some kind of weird, you know, experimental, you know, government thing that was happening, or, you know, some strange atmospheric phenomenon that, you know, is anything other than aliens, basically, just because aliens is such an extreme answer to a question that could have many different kinds of answers.
Right. One more, just quick call. We only have a few seconds left, but Miguel, can you make it quick? Hi.
You see, yes. Why do you think there is so much censorship on this issue, especially when anytime anybody ever brings up the idea of, you know, interdimensional reptilians and shapeshifters?
So you gave us a little idea of, actually you took the question that I asked to a different level, which is great, but where can we go online to get some of these spectacular pictures? I always think that we should have more information.
Right. I'll say, you know, I use the internet myself every single hour of every day to do my work, and I feel like there's so much information available that I don't see any censorship or attempt to limit that. What I think are some great resources that if I could just, you know, require everybody in high school to look at least one time, they would be online sites like, you know, the Hubble Image Gallery.
Okay.
I would require every, you know, human on Earth to look at the SOHO images.
Okay.
SOHO, that's a solar observatory that is actually managed by the European Space Agency.
And we'll get more from you and put them on our Facebook page.
Absolutely.
This has been terrific. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Had a great hour. Thanks. Dr. Margaret Turnbull, our guest, astrobiologist. Thanks to Marika Suval for producing this show and Scotty Myers for on-air production in Milwaukee.